Hi, I'm Neil Stavem. Thanks for checking out this podcast from Connecting Faith. You can hear the show live each weekday at noon Central Time, and there are many more podcasts for this and all our Faith Radio shows available online. Our web address is myfaithradio.com. And thanks for your gifts to this listener-supported ministry. Enjoy the podcast.
Always expect something good on your lunch hour. Connecting Faith with Life.
Hello and welcome once again to Connecting Faith here on the Faith Radio Network. I'm Neil Stavem, and we're always grateful that you would take out a little time to spend with us and enter into the conversation. We've got a great topic to discuss today, and maybe because it's summer and there's plenty of warmth around it, Ted, we can talk about climate change and things. So
it'll be interesting. You know, recently the most interesting phrase that I've picked up with climatology and climate change is polar vortex.
Okay.
I don't like what it is, but picked it up. Yeah.
Well, and whatever happened, did the El Nino, is that still?
Still around, I think.
Is that, okay. Yeah. All right. Well, we'll find out about that and more. And it may be that you have some questions as it relates to care of creation, environmental issues, climate change, certainly, because there's lots of discussion about it and lots of agendas about it as well. And we're happy to have a spokesperson for the Cornwall Alliance for the Stewardship Creation. And we've talked with Dr. E. Calvin Beisner in the past, and I always appreciate the opportunity to get together with him. He's the founder and the national spokesman for the Cornwall Alliance for the Stewardship Creation. Cornwall Alliance is a network of theologians, pastors, other ministry leaders, as well as scientists, economists, other scholars, and policy experts committed to applying biblical principles to the twin challenges of economic development for the very poor around the world and wise earth stewardship. Now, those are areas that I think we all can agree to say those are important areas, and so we're happy to have Dr. Beisner on with us. He's a graduate of the University of Southern California, a BA in Interdisciplinary Studies in Religion and Philosophy. He has a master's in society with a specialization in economic ethics and a PhD in history. And so he knows a lot, and he'll tell some of what he knows with us in ways that we can understand. But recently, it was just, I think, the ninth International Conference on Climate Change. The Heritage Foundation awarded him the Outstanding Spokesman for Faith, Science, and Stewardship, I think. Was that what it was, Cal?
Yes, it was. Okay. Thank you, Neil.
Congratulations on that. And we agree. You're a great spokesman and great insight for us all the time, and we're just happy to have you on with us. It's, by the way, cornwallalliance.org, the website, or check them out on Facebook as well, Cornwall Alliance for the Stewardship of Creation. But, Cal, let's talk with... maybe start out with a little bigger picture issue. What happens when we begin to worship creation rather than the Creator? Because that seems like there is a certain worship aspect to much of the what's going on in environmental debate today.
Well, I think what happens is that really we turn everything upside down. The picture that we get at the beginning of the Bible in Genesis, we could put it this way, that there's a hierarchy: God at the top, human beings next, and then the rest of the created order under human beings, because God created us in His image and told us that we were to fill the earth and have dominion over it, not an abusive, exploitative use of the earth, but rather the way we put it here at the Cornwall Alliance, godly dominion, which means men and women created in God's image, laboring together to enhance the fruitfulness, the beauty, and the safety of the earth to the glory of God and the benefit of our neighbors, so that we're really addressing the two great commandments there, loving God and loving neighbor. But there is this hierarchy. God is at the top, human beings are next, and then the rest of the created order is under us, under our authority. What happens when we start worshiping the creation instead of the Creator is that, first of all, we turn that hierarchy upside down, and in fact, in many instances, we cut part of it out, namely God. We put creation at the top, and human beings then begin to serve the creation instead of serving God. And so we really then are no longer in dominion over it. And then God, well, if he's there at all, of course atheists don't think he is, but God kind of comes last. Further than that, of course, the Apostle Paul tells us in Romans 1 that when you begin to worship and serve the creature rather than the creator, well, God, who will not share his glory with anyone else, gives you over to what Paul calls a reprobate mind. Professing yourself to be wise, you become a fool, and you begin to exchange all sorts of natural things for unnatural things. Paul goes into a whole long list of these things, rebellion against authority, change of sexual use of male and female, and so on. So essentially, when you get God out of the picture, when you serve the creature instead of the creator, all of your life gets messed up.
Cal, have Christians been, I guess, maybe sort of complicit in bringing about some of this strong change in maybe the way we view environment, and certainly all the promotion of an agenda now? I mean, have we had sort of exhibited poor theology in terms of earth stewardship, and so there's been maybe kind of a void, and where others have sort of jumped in and said, well, here's a new path to take?
You know, I think sometimes that has indeed happened. I don't think it's as widespread as a lot of people in the environmental movement think it is. But as an illustration of that, I once heard Jonathan Merritt, who is the son of a former president of the Southern Baptist Convention, went to Liberty University and then on to seminary at Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary, and has been an outspoken evangelical environmentalist now for about 5 or 6 years or so. I heard Jonathan testify once that before he really began to think through environmental issues, he described himself as a kind of a conservative Republican redneck who thought just fine of driving down the highway and tossing out litter from his takeout food out the window of the car. And he just thought, you know, there's no need to take care of the world. That's green stuff. It's part of the green movement, and we can just ignore that. Now, I can understand how someone who had done that would, upon coming to realize that instead we're supposed to be good stewards of the world, would want to run very much in the opposite direction, which is exactly what Jonathan has done. But frankly, that does not describe what the Bible says we were supposed to be doing. And I don't think that it describes the typical Christian attitude toward the earth. But where the idea came from, really, was an article published in Science magazine in 1967 by Lynn White Jr. called "The Religious Roots." The Historical Roots of Our Ecological Crisis, in which he blamed Judaism and Christianity for ecological crisis, on the grounds that Genesis 1:28 says we're supposed to have dominion over the earth, and he viewed that dominion as entirely exploitative and abusive, and in fact said that Christianity and Judaism had said that this verse authorized us to abuse the earth. Now, the problem with that is that, frankly, you can go all through both pre-Christian and post-Christian rabbinic commentary, you can go all through Christian commentators and theologians on that verse, and you'll never find them saying that this justifies abusing the earth. So that was a caricature. It was a straw man designed to cast opprobrium on the Christian faith. And unfortunately, it nonetheless became very widespread in the environmental movement. That essay has been republished hundreds of times in various different anthologies and very, very influential.
We'll talk more about some of the caricatures and straw men as we talk about this debate, which is pretty significant going on, and lots of dollars and effort spent on environmental care, in particular as it relates to climate change. I am interested to maybe just jump in with, we'll jump in and talk about climate change. And why don't we take a break first, and we'll come back and we can unpack those a little bit more fully. Won't have to worry about the time break in there with Dr. Cal Beisner. Calvin Beisner is the founder and national spokesman of the Cornwall Alliance for the Stewardship of Creation. And he has authored a number of books. There's a great teaching series that he's done, a DVD study series and the like. They have a regular email. You can get updates on the work of the Cornwall Alliance. I would encourage you to check it out on their website, cornwallalliance.org. You can find them on Facebook as well, Cornwall Alliance for the Stewardship of Creation. And we will talk more with Cal Beisner in just a moment here on Connecting Faith. By the way, you'd like to join in the conversation, maybe have a question as it relates to climate change or environmental care, the number is 877-933-2484. It's 877-93-FAITH.
Or 84.
Time this summer already, or if not soon, to maybe just get away, find a place outside that you can just enjoy the beauty of God's creation and give God praise for his handiwork. And we're talking about care of creation, a stewardship of creation. That's part of what Dr. Cal Beisner has given his life toward. He's the founder and national spokesman of the Cornwall Alliance for the Stewardship of Creation. It's a network of theologians, pastors, ministry leaders, scientists, economists, scholars, policy experts, all looking at applying biblical principles to the challenges of economic development for the very poor around the world and wise earth stewardship. And Dr. Cal Beisner has published over 10 books and hundreds of articles, contributed to many others. And he's joining with us today on Connecting Faith. The number is 877-93-FAITH. If you have a question, and Cal, let me ask you, one of the comments that I saw in one of your news emails talked about concern for the poor. And you suggest that the environmental movement no longer cares for the poor. So maybe talk about that. And if not, then what is the highest priority of today's sort of modern environmental movement as we know it?
Yeah, I wouldn't quite say that the folks in the movement don't care. What I'd say is that a whole lot of what they want to do has unintended consequences that are really harmful to the poor, whether they care about the poor or not. It's really tempting for us to say, I care, therefore what I want to do is a good thing. But good intentions often go astray and have really bad unintended consequences. And I think that's that happens a lot in the environmental movement because of two things. One, there's a lot of bad science done in the movement, and two, there's a lot of bad economics. This is why the Cornwall Alliance, in our network of scholars, we focus on having scientists and economists, all of them solid evangelical Christians, but PhD scientists and economists who can do really good work in these fields. Let me give you a couple of examples. There is the idea that we can fight global warming by switching from fossil fuels to wind and solar and biofuels. Among those biofuels is ethanol. And for about the last decade, the U.S. EPA has required us to mix in a certain amount of ethanol with our gasoline supply every year. Well, the result of that, according to a very, very careful economic survey, has been that because we've shifted a whole lot of our corn crop from either human food or livestock food, which means feeding things that become food for humans, to ethanol and burning the result in our gas tanks, we've pushed up the price of grain around the world so much that we've caused an excess 192,000 premature deaths every year among the poor in developing countries. Another example would be that a lot of environmentalists think that DDT, which is the most affordable and most effective pesticide for controlling the mosquitoes that spread malaria, and we used it here in the United States to eliminate malaria, a lot of environmentalists think that that is really bad for the environment. As a matter of fact, though, the EPA's own tests back in the 1970s showed that it was thoroughly safe. and that Rachel Carson, in her book Silent Spring, had been quite mistaken about it. Nonetheless, for political reasons, purely political reasons, not scientific reasons, the U.S. banned it and then took on a policy of saying, we won't give foreign aid to countries that use DDT to fight malaria-carrying mosquitoes. And the result has been declining in recent years, but over the roughly 40 years since then, an average of about 2 million malaria deaths every year in sub-Saharan Africa and parts of Asia and Latin America. Plus, of course, hundreds of millions of malaria cases that, you know, from which people don't die, but nonetheless, they're very, very ill, they're in tremendous pain, and they're not able to work, which means they can't lift themselves out of poverty. So those are a couple of examples. And the simple fact that so many environmentalists don't think about the consequences on cost of living from a lot of the policies that they want to pursue indicates that, or reflects, I think, the fact that it's very much an elite movement. The average income of members of various environmental organizations and donors to them is way above the average income in whatever country you might be looking at. So there's a sort of an elite attitude, and they figure, well, if I don't mind paying an extra $1,000 a year for electricity, which is about what it would cost to switch over a lot of our coal and natural gas plants to solar and wind. If I don't mind that, well, nobody else should mind it either. But frankly, there are a whole lot of poor people in this world for whom that would be devastating.
It's hard to weigh the cost of good intentions, I guess. And then I'm wondering, should pragmatism be kind of the determining factor, or would some say, well, we just have to do it because it's the right thing to do?
Well, pragmatism is, I think, a totally unbiblical philosophy. But consequentialism wedded to a biblical ethic of principles is appropriate. You know, when we look at various options in front of us, the first question we need to ask is it lawful according to God's moral law? If it's not lawful, hey, then we shouldn't do it at all, no matter what we think might be the consequences, no matter how good we think they might be. But there are a lot of lawful alternatives in front of us, and once you've determined that an alternative is lawful, that it's not immoral, then a consequentialist examination where you're trying to figure out, okay, where do we get the most benefit for the cost of doing such and such, that then makes entirely good and proper sense. You know, Jesus even tells the parable of the man who counts the cost before he begins building a tower, or rather another who doesn't count it, and he gets started and he can't finish it and he's seen to be a fool. Or he tells also, we need to make peace with God now rather than waiting to the end. And he illustrates that with someone who thinks in terms of, if I'm going to go into battle against this king, do I have enough troops for this? So counting the cost is an appropriate thing to do as Christians. Here's another illustration. In order for us to comply with the new proposed rule from the EPA that we have to reduce power plant carbon dioxide emissions by 30% by 2030, it would cost about $50 billion per year. Now, the effect of that would be undetectable on climate, on global average temperature over the remainder of this century. There's no discernible effect. But that $50 billion could instead be spent to build coal and natural gas-fired power plants around the developing world and to build the transmission lines to electrify the homes of all of the people in the world who do not now have electricity. Same cost, actually $500 million less, would do that, and the result would be the saving of literally millions of lives, because right now in those places, wood and dried dung are the primary cooking and heating fuels, and smoke from that kills about 4 million people a year, mostly women and children. and sickens hundreds of millions of others, again, trapping them in poverty because they can't work. So when we choose to spend $50 billion on this, which has no discernible effect, we can't spend it on that, which does. So there, a consequentialist analysis, I think, is entirely appropriate.
Well, you talked about the discernible effect, and it seems like when we'll get into talking about climate change, but it does seem like anyone who offers a critique of climate change are nearly universally discredited or maligned. So why is there so much animosity toward the skeptic?
Well, first off, what I just said is not a critique of climate change. It's not a critique of fear, of dangerous, man-made global warming. The EPA itself acknowledges in its own studies underlying the new proposed rule that compliance with this rule would not have a discernible effect on global average temperature in the coming century. It estimates, by computer modeling, that it would reduce global average temperature by less than 0.02 degrees by the end of this century. Well, that's not measurable in terms of actual measurement of the atmospheric temperature. It certainly is not feelable. It isn't going to affect any ecosystem or any people anywhere. So even assuming their position, that's the conclusion there. But why do people get scorned for questioning climate alarmism? Well, I think it's because the climate alarmists have done a really good job, a really excellent job, of creating the illusion of vast scientific consensus, and they have managed to get people to forget that consensus is a political term, not a scientific term. The reality is that science is all about skepticism. You're constantly wanting to test all things, hold fast what is good, is the way Paul puts it in 1 Thessalonians 5:21. That's not just a biblical value, that's a scientific value, and it's part of what is the very foundation of science. But second, that supposed consensus is not even real. Every different study attempting to demonstrate it has had fatal flaws, and in fact, far more scientists publicly, very explicitly, have endorsed a statement that there is no convincing scientific evidence that human emissions of carbon dioxide or other greenhouse gases are causing or in the foreseeable future will cause dangerous climate change, and that instead there is very good evidence that the rising CO2 is benefiting the Earth's ecosystems and all life on Earth by increasing plant growth, since plants depend on CO2 for photosynthesis, and the more CO2 there is in the atmosphere, the better they do. That's what is called the Oregon Petition, and it's at petitionproject.org. Over 31,000 American scientists, including over 9,000 PhDs, many of them with their degrees directly in fields related to atmospheric chemistry, atmospheric physics, climatology, and so on, have signed that statement. The other side can't show anything remotely like that. Now, the point of that is not to say, and therefore this is scientifically true. It is instead to say, the claim of consensus on the other side is wrong. Now, let's get away from consensus and look at actual evidence.
And we'll get into some of that here. We'll talk about the explaining how predictions and observations are different, and invite you into the conversation. If you'd like to join us, talking to Dr. Calvin Beisner today from the Cornwall Alliance for the Stewardship of Creation. Our phone number is 877-933-2484. It's 877-933-2484. If you want to drop us a note, you can do that online, myfaithradio.com, and then click on the Connecting Faith show page. There's an email link there, and we'll talk more with Cal Beisner in just a moment. Stay tuned.
He's got the whole world in his hands. He's got the whole wide world in his hands. He's got the whole world in his hands. He's got the whole world in his hands.
Getting warmer, too, in his hands, right? Isn't that what they say? And I just saw that the news the other day. The temp's gone up 0.00 something, I guess. But, Cal Weisner, Dr. Calvin Weisner is a spokesman for the Cornwall Alliance for the Stewardship of Creation. He's also author and speaker on the application of the biblical worldview to economics, government, and environmental policies. Published over 10 books, hundreds of articles, and speaks nationally, internationally. And you can find out more about the good work of the Cornwall Alliance by going to cornwallalliance.org. You can find them on Facebook as well. Cal, we were just touching before the break a little bit about, the observations, the critiques of, the whole issue around climate change. But maybe just talk a bit about how predictions and observations are different and why it's important to distinguish between the two.
Yeah, well, it's important to distinguish between the two because science is all about testing our hypotheses by observing the real world around us. And unfortunately, actually, a whole lot of climate scientists actually seem to be forgetting that very thing. A sociologist of science by the name of Mayanna Lassen published an article about a decade ago called Seductive Simulations, based on her having spent about, 6 years, living and working with the climate scientists at the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Boulder, Colorado. And the fundamental question she had in mind was, do these scientists in practice really remember that their models are not the real world? Now, by the way, we can't write this off on the grounds that Lassen is a climate skeptic. She's not. She very much believes in catastrophic anthropogenic global warming. But what she found in observing them at work and in formal interviews with them was that most of these scientists had lost the ability to distinguish the difference between their models and the output of those models, computer models that supposedly mimic how the Earth's climate system functions, and the climate system itself. And what that means is that they've forgotten what real science is. They're not really doing it. Now, what do we get? What do we find out when we compare the model projections with the real world? Well, it's not a pretty picture. If you graph the 102-some computer climate models that are used by scientists around the world, especially with the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, if you graph their what they call post-dictions or retro-dictions of climate, how it should have been over the last 30 years or so, as well as their predictions of what's coming up, what you find is that starting in the early 1990s, the projected or post-dicted, the modeled temperatures, diverge hugely from the reality, all upward. And by the time we get to the present, 95% plus of the models have about a double projection of temperature from what the actual trend has been. And in fact, none of them is as low as the observed temperatures. And the average runs between almost four times as much warming as there's been in the last 30 years. Not only that, but not a single model predicted that there would be no statistically significant global warming from 1977 to the present. But that's what the real-world observations show. No warming for the last 17 years and 10 months now. As a result, we really need to redo the models. We need to reconfigure our theory of how CO2 affects climate, particularly how it affects global average temperature. And we need to reduce greatly our estimate of how much warming you get from CO2. And I think where the science is going on that is toward a conclusion that it is probably less than one-sixth of what the alarmists have claimed. They've thought that a best estimate was about 3 degrees Celsius of warming from a doubling of CO2 in the atmosphere. I think we're going to find that it's more like about 0.5 degree. That's not dangerous by anybody's book. And in fact, it is probably quite beneficial on the whole.
We can get to a call here in a minute, but I was just thinking. I think I did just see that out the other day that the global temperatures are up or something. The warmest they've been. So when we see something like that, I mean, you know, even if it is presented as not necessarily it's supposedly just as a factual statement, but somehow we read it and go, oh, well, this obviously is buttressing the case that climate change is happening.
Yeah, I saw recently this claim that June was the warmest month that we've had on record.
Yeah.
There are some interesting questions to ask about that sort of thing. Which particular data set are you looking at? There are a variety of different ones to consider. Some of them will perhaps support that. Some of them will not. But another question is, what's the record that you have in mind? How long does that record go back? Because if it's talking, for instance, about the satellite record, measuring Earth's atmospheric temperatures from satellites, that only goes back to 1979. We know for sure, for instance, that 1934 was significantly warmer than the warmest year since the recent global warming started in 1977. That year was 1998. We know for sure, I think, that the medieval warm period, running from about 800 or 900 to about 1200 AD, got warmer than the present has been. So there are all sorts of questions to ask about that. And then besides that, you know, frankly, I don't know any skeptics of global warming, and I would count myself one. I don't know any who don't agree that there has been global warming in the last 150 years or so. We've been coming out of the Little Ice Age, which went from about 1350 to 1850, and we've been trending upward. Now, when you trend upward for a while, it's normal. It is mathematically necessary that recent times will be warmer than less recent times. So even if we've hit a plateau, there's been no statistically significant warming for the last 17 years and 10 months. Nonetheless, any given month during that period on the plateau is going to be warmer than months before you reached the plateau. And then besides that, too, there's actually been some very, very slight cooling from about 2001 to the present in terms of global average temperature on an annual basis.
Thanks, Cal. Dr. Calvin Bison is my guest today from the Cornwall Alliance. We're talking climate change, environmental stewardship, all those things. Larry is calling in, has a question, ag-related question. Larry, go ahead.
I'd like to hear your thoughts on conventional agriculture, if you feel that the way that conventional agriculture is going today, if that's sustainable. And I'm looking for a Christian viewpoint on how we treat the land and how we raise food for the people that consume what we grow.
Okay. Not quite sure what you mean by conventional agriculture. Probably you mean something like industrial agriculture, very, very intensive farming, intensive animal husbandry.
Well, I was wondering, Larry, maybe just to clarify, are you talking about in terms of like no-till versus kind of the full plowing and disking, all those kinds of things? Or
well, that's part of it, too, because the carbon content of the soil has definitely gone down in this country in the last 200 years.
Okay. All right. I'll let Cal kind of respond to that.
Well, first off, I'd say that if it were not for very intensive farming that enables us to get very high yields from very few acres, we would have to farm much more land than we actually do to feed the world's population. The result would be more loss of habitat for other species, more loss of beautiful wilderness area, more loss of forest, and so on. So if we're able to raise yield per acre significantly by various different methods, that's a pretty good thing to do. Now, there are costs to doing that in terms of sometimes runoff of chemical fertilizers and so on. Those need to be studied carefully, and we need to find out the best way to balance these various different concerns. But aiming for very high yields from our acres is, I think, a good thing, because what it does is it makes food more affordable for people around the world, and at the same time it preserves land. Now, there are some humanitarian concerns about some forms of contemporary conventional agriculture, and actually we have one member of our network of scholars, Dr. Nelson Klosterman, who is a theologian, is working on a major paper for us right now on the ethics of animal husbandry, answering claims that conventional agriculture is inhumane in various ways. It can be, but it need not be, and it certainly shouldn't be. But there are all sorts of interesting questions about what do we mean by humane ethic for animals, and what does it really mean to be caring for them, to be compassionate toward them. Those are questions with some pretty deep biblical implications, and frankly, I'm looking forward to seeing how Dr. Klosterman handles them for us in his paper.
In the meantime, Larry, just to encourage you to check out cornwallalliance.org and just to kind of scroll around to see what kind of resources that you can find there, and maybe some helpful insight on applying a biblical worldview to areas of economics and government and environmental policy and perhaps agriculture as well. On a related note, one of our regular callers, Frank, wanted to know your opinion about sort of genetically modified crops and some of those things.
Well, we've been genetically modifying crops and even animals for thousands of years. We've done it by means of hybridization. That's a fairly low-tech way of doing it. You get two things that can crossbreed, and then you wonder, okay, what traits are going to be crossed over from one to another? And you kind of do it, and you experiment, and you see what happens. You can get pretty good at that over a period of time, but it's still very low-tech. Genetic modification in most people's minds now means specifically genetic engineering done at a microscopic level, literally a genetic or molecular level, where we intentionally take one chromosome from the DNA of one species, and we splice that into the DNA of another species. And some people, I think, are very frightened about this. I think actually the rational response instead is to be far less frightened, because here we know pretty solidly the traits that this one gene controls, and so when we splice it in somewhere else, we have a much better ability to know in advance the result than when we're just simply doing hybridization. And the truth is that genetic engineering has made tremendous contributions to crop yield on the one hand, but also to the actual nutritive value of various crops. For instance, there's golden rice, which has been genetically modified so that it has more vitamin A in it. That golden rice can eliminate blindness for millions of children in the developing world. And that I think is a wonderful thing. So I'm not concerned about genetic engineering in and of itself. Every technology has the potential for abuse, but it's not the technique itself that is the problem. It's what we use that technique for. I mean, I can use a kitchen knife to slice my roast, or I can use it to murder somebody. The latter is a very bad thing to do with a kitchen knife. Mm-hmm. But the former, I think, is a good thing.
Yeah. Dr. E. Calvin Beisner is a guest today, and he is a spokesman for the Cornwall Alliance for the Stewardship of Creation, author, speaker, and working on applying the biblical worldview to economics, government, and environmental policy, and authored some 10 books. You can find out more about him online at cornwallalliance.org, or check out Facebook, Cornwall Alliance for the Stewardship of Creation. And join with us here in just a minute as we continue our conversation. If you have a question, we've still got time to get one in for you. It's 877-93-FAITH, 877-933-2484. We're going to talk about a wager that has been presented, and we'll see what Cal thinks about that in a moment. Stay tuned.
Music.
MBA, University of Northwestern, St. Paul.
Past the hour, talking about caring for creation today and applying biblical worldview to economics, government, environmental policy. And there's lots of discussion about environment these days and climate change and the like. In fact, Dr. Cal Beiser recently responded to a wager opportunity from Dr. Keating. Maybe just tell us a little bit about what that was and why you didn't take him up on it.
Yeah, a physicist, Dr. Christopher Keating, has posted on the web a $10,000 bet, an offer to pay anybody $10,000 who can, quote, prove via the scientific method that man-made global climate change is not occurring, unquote. Well, first off, of course, he commits a major mistake right there. It is, by definition, impossible to prove by the scientific method a universal negative. As a good scientist, he should certainly know that. But there are some other problems, too. I mean, first of all, Keating says, I am the final judge of all entries, but will provide my comments on why any entry fails to prove the point. Well, that makes him a judge in his own case. You know, you might ask some lawyer, what does conflict of interest mean? He's offering 10 grand, and he's going to be the judge as to whether you've convinced the case. But there's a bigger problem, a much bigger problem behind this, and that is that Keating has rigged the bet. It's like an Old West poker player who stacks the deck, he marks the cards, he seats his opponents so that he can see their hands in the mirrors, and he hides a few aces up his sleeve. This is what Keating does. He says that he will pay this if someone can prove that man-made global climate change is not occurring. Well, I don't know any climate skeptics who would say that man-made climate change is not occurring. What they do deny is that human emissions of greenhouse gases have been the primary cause of global warming over the last 50 or so years. They deny that the harms likely to come from those emissions will exceed the benefits. And they deny that the benefits of mitigating the warming, reducing the warming, by emitting less CO2 would exceed the harms. Keating's challenge would have been a little more respectable if he'd said, I will award $10,000 of my own money to anyone that can prove via the scientific method that human emissions of greenhouse gases have not been the primary cause of global warming over the last 50 years or so, that the harms likely to come from those emissions are not likely to exceed the benefits, and that the benefits of mitigating the warming by reducing the emissions will not likely exceed the harms. But that's not what he said. And in either case, he should also set forth objective, publicly recognizable criteria by which to make the judgment. He's not done that. It's just the whole thing is really bogus.
Which sadly seems like there's a lot of heat and maybe not a lot of light when it comes to this subject in general.
Yes, but it becomes helpful ammo in the chest of the climate alarmists. They can see nobody's done this.
Yeah. Good point. Let's take a quick call from Gary before our time runs out. Gary's listening in Faith 1190 in Madison. You're on with Dr. Cal Beiser. Go ahead.
Yes, I watch quite a few television programs about wildlife, and one of the things I continue to see is the extinction of the polar bears, how the polar caps in the globe are melting, glaciers are going away. Can you please make a comment on that?
Sure. The polar bears are doing very well, thank you. As a matter of fact, their numbers now are higher than they've been in any time in the last 70 years or so. There is no trend toward extinction for them. There are about 13 colonies of polar bears around the Arctic region. Of those, 11 have actually been growing in numbers. Only two were shrinking somewhat in numbers, but those are explained not by any change in the average temperature where they live, but instead by hunting, and that could be turned around by the hunting, but there really isn't any need to in those places. So the polar bear thing has been a great photo op kind of PR campaign by the climate alarmists. It has not had anything to do with good solid science. As for the shrinkage of glaciers, first let me address actually a different sort of ice, that's sea ice. North polar sea ice has shrunk with some cycling up and down, but it's shrunk generally over the last 30 years or so. But we do not know that its extent is less than it was in, say, the 1930s. We've only been able to measure it from satellites for about the last 40 years. But south polar sea ice, Antarctic sea ice, has been growing over the same period, and the total amount of sea ice in the world is actually larger over this period rather than smaller. Now, if shrinking polar sea ice is supposed to be an evidence of global warming, you need to be looking at both poles, not just the North Pole. And as it turns out, the much better explanation of the trends at the North Pole has to do with changes in ocean currents, changes that are cyclical. So we can leave that. Glacial ice. The only shrinkage of glacial ice that could be of any real concern is that on Greenland and on Antarctica. Those are the only two places where there's enough glacial ice to have a significant impact on sea level rise. There has been some shrinkage in both, if you believe some of the figures anyway, for instance, cited in the National Climate Assessment. But that shrinkage actually amounts to, in the case of Greenland, about 0.01% per decade, and in Antarctica to about 0.0045% per decade. So slight that if you graph it, you can't even discern it. It would contribute about 1 millimeter per year to sea level rise, which is not particularly significant in terms of long-term sea level rise trends, because we are still actually rising out of the last ice age. And as the planet warms, yeah, you'll get some shrinkage of land ice. But sea level rise has not accelerated in the last 50 years or so. There's no evidence that that any warming based on human CO2 emissions has caused any acceleration in sea level rise. So that, too, is something that we, frankly, don't need to be concerned about.
We only have, Cal, about 3 minutes left, but I wanted to give you an opportunity maybe just say a word about, you know, God's creation that surrounds us in which we live and how it is, you know, how we are sufficiently cared for if we use it wisely. I mean, just enlighten us a bit about that.
Yeah, as I said at the beginning of the program, I mean, we really are called to be good stewards of this earth. In Genesis 1:28, God says to Adam and Eve, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth, subdue it and have dominion over the fish of the sea, the birds of the air, and everything that moves on the face of the earth." That dominion is not to be abusive, but rather to be one where we actually enhance the fruitfulness, the beauty, and the safety of the earth, to the glory of God and to the benefit of our neighbors. That's what we want to do. But one thing we need to be careful about is that we don't think of this earth as a terribly fragile place. If you Google the words fragile and environment together, you'll come up with literally millions of hits. Because much of the environmental movement thinks of the environment, and for instance, of the climate system, as extremely fragile, which is why they're worried that a doubling of CO2 concentration in the atmosphere, which, hey, doubling sounds big until you realize that would be from 0.028% of the atmosphere to 0.054% of the atmosphere. They think that doubling could cause catastrophic climate change. I don't think that's consistent with the biblical understanding that an infinitely wise and omniscient God designed the earth and its climate system. an omnipotent God created the earth and its climate system, and a faithful God sustains it. And this God promised himself in Genesis chapter 8 that as long as heaven and earth endure, summer and winter, day and night, seed time and harvest, cold and heat will not cease. That is, the various different cycles on which life depends, God has promised to sustain. Doesn't mean we can't do anything damaging to the environment, but it does mean that we need to be careful not to expect huge, disastrous results from tiny, tiny impacts on the environment.
At that point, we need to break off our conversation. It's been a fascinating hour, as always. Dr. Calvin Beisner, founder and national spokesman of the Cornwall Alliance for the Stewardship of Creation. Check them out online, cornwallalliance.org. You find them on Facebook as well. Dr. Beisner has published over 10 books and hundreds of articles. And you can find a podcast of the show online at myfaithradio.com.